Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect Radio for the week beginning Sunday, the 18th of July. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. This week, the final part of Anthea Page's interview with blind world traveller Tony Giles from Weston. You may have seen him playing up and down Stokes Croft with an orange jersey on with the words Jesus Saves. We find out why Simon gave up a promising career as a solicitor to become an evangelist.
And we're off to Romania this week and the cemetery where former President Ceausescu was buried. Anthea Page is there to review the rights and wrongs of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
And also hot off the press is the July and August edition of the Little Prompt magazine from the Avon Association of Drama. And of course, Jeff Sparks is here to tell us all about what's coming up in the world of rock this week. So we start this week with part two of the Tales of the Blind Traveller.
Tony Giles is from Weston-super-Mare, and although he is severely disabled, travels the world and inspires others to do the same. Dialect's roving reporter Anthea Page met Tony Giles in a hostel in Plovdiv, central Bulgaria. And in part two of the interview this week, he explains which countries have been the most challenging to travel through.
So which country's been the most challenging for you?
Sri Lanka, Vietnam, basically because there's no infrastructure, and also Venezuela. Venezuela is probably the most difficult country because of the language barrier. Virtually no one speaks English, and my Spanish isn't good enough. And also lack of infrastructure. There's holes in the pavements and broken sidewalks. And food's another thing. Someone who can see can walk into a restaurant or a fast food place, and they can see very quickly what's on the menu. And when you can't see, you've got to ask someone, and doing it in a foreign country can be very, very difficult.
You must have inspired lots of people to travel who thought it was practically impossible with their condition.
People say it's inspiring or it's brave and great to meet me and, you know, continual travelling. And I just recently received an email from a guy I met, one of his friends. He's disabled from a back injury. Just inspiring to keep each other going more than anything. You know, that sense that you're not alone, I suppose, that's the biggest thing. It's not for everyone, travelling around the world, alone with a backpack, sitting on a bus for 40, 50, 60 hours. That's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. So the idea to write my book was just to inspire someone who doesn't feel they have the confidence just to, you know, do something, just to be able to go down their own street. That's the idea behind it, really.
So what country haven't you been to that you want to visit?
I've got the big four, Japan, India, Russia, and China, although if I didn't go to China, I wouldn't lose sleep over it. But yeah, certainly India would be amazing, Russia and Japan.
So do you get more of a sense of the smell of the country because you can't see it?
It's a combination of things. It's the food, it's the smells. I mean, just today, we're walking in the countryside in Bulgaria and smelling the freshness of the air and the flowers, the countryside, hearing the sound of water, which I love. I have a passion for the sea and waterfalls. That's one thing, hearing music, different culture, different countries' music, especially Latin music. And the energy in music is amazing and very emotional. But it also the history. I'm interested in history of people, history of countries. It's all a learning experience. You can only read so much from books and from studying. You need to go to countries and visit, meet people, find out what they think about things, what they feel about things, how they live day in, day out. I've been very lucky to travel, and I think the more I've traveled, the more humble I've become as a person, and I think I've become a better person through traveling.
Tell us again, just to finish off, what your website is.
My website is www.tonytheTraveller.com.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, that was Tony Giles, blind and 80% deaf, but travelling the world, talking to Anthea Page, and you can read Tony's book on his website, which is www.tonytheTraveller.com.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
On his orange jacket, it says Jesus Saves. He is known as Stokescroft Simon, and you may have seen him wandering around distributing leaflets about God and Jesus. But what made him give up a promising career as a solicitor to ply the streets talking about Jesus? Dialect's Richard Cowley spoke to him earlier this week.
You're obviously a charismatic-looking person, you know, the beard, the very obvious loud Jesus Saves vest that you wear, so you can be seen quite easily, and I'm fairly sure that a lot of people have seen you walking around the streets for the years. I certainly have. How did you actually come to be involved with Jesus?
Well, I believe since a child. I've never disbelieved the message, but when I was 24, I gave my life to Jesus. I repented of my sins, and I learnt that Jesus wanted all Christians to spread the gospel. It's called the Great Commission, which is to get other people into heaven. And so I decided to do that from the age of 24.
Were you recruited in any way by any specific church or organisation to do this?
I got involved with a church called the London Church of Christ, which were highly evangelical. I met a black guy, actually, and he was leading a very moral life. In fact, the only man that I'd ever met who was moral. And so I was attracted by that and taught by them and baptised by them. Well, I was actually at Guildford Law School training to be a solicitor at the time, but the main church was in London, yeah.
Did you succeed in that endeavour as a solicitor?
No, I preferred to spread the gospel. And 10 years ago, approximately, Jesus told me that that's what he wanted me to do full time.
Do you think that morally and ethically, as you're studying law, that you're now doing the Lord's work?
Well,
perhaps in a different way.
Well, law was a good preparation. It's trained my mind. I studied it at Cambridge University. I know how to sort of use logic and follow arguments, be rational. But spreading the gospel is infinitely better to my mind than being a solicitor. I mean, soliciting, all you do really is you get people sort of help on this earth. But spreading the gospel, it lasts forever.
People tend to be afraid or have a lack of confidence in approaching the church in general. So if they see you walking around with the big signpost Jesus Saves that you wear and leafleting, how do you think they respond initially to that?
Well, that's the great thing. Jesus said, go and make disciples. He didn't say sit back and let them come to you. He said, take the initiative. You know the good news. Now go and share it. So yeah, that's exactly what I do. I wear these Jesus things on my back and front so that people will know what I'm about or who I'm about. And I offer them a leaflet and it says heaven on, and they take it and they read it. So yeah, I make the initiative and I go to them, which is what God commands.
Of course, your image, I think you realise that, with your beard particularly being very pronounced in its growth, do you think your image is in any way typical of a disciple from the past?
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, Jesus had a beard because it says in the Bible that they pulled his beard out when they tortured him. And as we know, most more primitive, closer to the origins societies, men have beards. So yeah, I think it's a good thing. Yeah, the gospel's open to all people. Yeah, we know that that God chose the Israelites to be his people in the flesh before Jesus came, and that's actually a type, which means a sort of symbol, identification with the church, that the church is God's people in the spirit since Jesus came.
Can you comment and advise people on how best to politically move in the best directions?
Well, yeah, we do all have to give up sin. It's called repentance. I did it. Everyone has to do it. God commands. And it's for our good because, you know, sins like drunkenness or being immoral or taking drugs harm us. So God wants the best for us.
That was Stokescroft Simon talking about his own interpretation of the Bible.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
intrepid reporter Anthea Page, as you might have gathered, has been travelling around Eastern Europe recently, collecting interviews about life under the communist era. This week we visit the Ghencea Civil Cemetery in Bucharest, where former Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife Elena lie buried.
We've just arrived at Ghencea Civil Cemetery in Bucharest, and we're walking up the main avenue towards a little chapel to find the grave of Ceaușescu, who is not buried with his wife. They're in separate graves. And afterwards, we're going to hear about the terrible times in Romania. So we've turned off the main avenue and we're going down in a small path. We're here. It's a raised pile of earth with red fabric flowers on it that are all faded. It's not well tended. It's got a black metal wrought iron work fence around it. And it just says Ceausescu Nicolae, 1918 to 1989. Can you just say your name?
Bogdan.
Can you tell us what it says at the bottom?
It says that this monument was built by the Party of Romanian Workers.
He was an atheist, apparently, and at the other side of the grave is a cross. So I'm going down another little overgrown path. Ah, no, this is much bigger, and it's actually got his photograph on it in the little medallion, showing him as middle age. This one's in marble. It's about 7'6", 8 foot tall. What does it say here?
It says, "Tears on your grave on behalf of the Romanian people."
We found it. Elena Ceausescu, very poor grave. It's got a metal, black metal railing round and a simple black cross. And what does it say on there?
Jesus, the Nazarenian, the King of the Jews.
And Elena Ceausescu, written in white paint on the black cross.
But,
and it's
we didn't, is Elena here?
She's not here?
No, suppose we're here.
Same for Ceausescu?
Same for Ceausescu, because our communist party, Iliescu, and the Camarilla, past 20 years, not saying nothing where it is.
So it's still a mystery?
It's a mystery.
So we've come back to the grave of Ceausescu. You were in Bucharest at the time of the revolution. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Theoretically, people speak about the revolution, even though historians have already proved that it was no revolution. It was just, well, a kind of vendetta. People belonging to the Communist Party wanted to get rid of Ceausescu and to change the system. In the beginning, it was not even their intention to change the communist system, but only the leader. Since people started to shout against the system and wanted to change the system too, they decided that it's almost impossible to keep the communism in Romania, the communist system in Romania. It all started actually on the 16th of December in Timișoara, where a Protestant Hungarian pastor was supposed to be moved over to another city in Romania, and both Romanians and Hungarians protested against this decision. On the 17th of December, people started to shout against Ceausescu and against the communist system. So he ordered a kind of political demonstration on the 21st of December in Bucharest in order to show to the Romanian community and to the world that the communist regime in Romania is still very, very strong, and that it can rely on the support of the people. Probably he brought altogether more than 100,000 people, and at a certain moment people started to shout against him. It was probably 5 minutes of panic. The demonstration was broadcasted on TV. They stopped the transmission and they started to play patriotic songs. Most people were just sent away from this square where the demonstration took place, but they gathered in the university square where they started to protest against Ceausescu and against the regime.
Now, you went there, didn't you, in the afternoon?
Yes, I was there in the afternoon. It was a lot of enthusiasm, but on the other hand also a lot of fear. It was possible to see people in the square just shouting against Ceausescu, protesting against him, but on the other hand also people just walking without even looking at those who were protesting against the regime. So the fear, it was terrible during those days. People were aware of the fact that if Ceausescu would have won this battle, all those who protested against him would have not necessarily been killed by Ceausescu, but for sure imprisoned. And it was not only a question of those who protested against him, but also a question of their families.
So what could they expect in prison?
Well, probably thousands of hours of torture. After that, they would have been convicted by the judges and probably spent the next 10, 15 years in prison. If not, we can also speak about the possibility of getting killed. Because on the 21st of December, there are people that, the police at that time arrested thousands of people. They were imprisoned and some of them died. Died during the interrogations, and they died because they were badly beaten by the police, by the militia, as it was called those days.
Did you know anyone who was killed or beaten at that time?
No. These names are public right now, and there are so many statements, public statements of the people that were in prison those days and got beaten by the militia, and they all say that it was terrible.
So there was another demonstration by the miners later on, and that was bloodthirsty as well.
Yes, it happened in June 1990. So after getting rid of Ceausescu, our first president, he also belonged to the communist system. He was actually a high member of the communist hierarchy before 1989. He won the elections on the 20th of May 1990. People were against the system that he tried to impose, so they started a political demonstration that lasted more than 2 months. And on the 13th of June, he decided that he needs to free the square of the university square where people were gathered. So he sent both militaries and policemen. People were terribly beaten. There were like rivers of blood on the streets. So it was 6 or 6:30 in the morning when they started to wash the streets because it was so much blood on the streets. And then people managed to get back into the square during the day. On the 13th of June during the night, Bucharest was transformed into a kind of war zone. So it was possible to hear shootings like it was Vietnam in Bucharest. And then on the 14th of June at 5:00 in the morning, the first miners showed up in Bucharest, and after listening to the speech of Mr. Iliescu, the elected president, in which he was just encouraging them to reinstore stability within the Romanian society, they just went to the university and to some other faculties of Bucharest, and they started to beat mainly students. But then it was a question of hazard. And there are so many people that supported Ion Iliescu, and they got beaten because they had long hair or they wear beard, which were signs of a decadent society, mainly for people coming out of the communism, where it was impossible or very difficult to wear beard or to wear long hair.
So do you remember that event?
Yes. I was on the streets, and it was absolutely terrible. It was absolute insecurity in the city. It was just a question of luck not to get beaten by these people. And there were thousands of them, thousands just marching through Bucharest and reinstalling the peaceful society that our president was talking about.
Now, you were saying earlier that Ceausescu was hated, but because of the economic situation, there's a feeling that the early years were quite good.
The issue is that right now people, they just suffer because of the economical measurements taken by the government. And they just remember that during those times, there was a sense of security, even though it was not possible to buy anything, even though it was during the winters, it was colder inside the apartments than outside. So it was absolutely terrible, but it was this sense of security. People had their jobs. The big leader was taking care of their needs. And right now, due to the fact that they lack money and that it's impossible for them to buy the products that they need or the medicine for the elderly especially, they just remember those times and they just remind Ceausescu as a leader that took care of some of their needs. But this is just a kind of minority within the Romanian society, because most people, they do not like Ceausescu. They do not remember him as the positive hero that was in charge with the welfare of the Romanian society during those days.
Well, of course, there's the mass destruction of parts of beautiful Bucharest that we've seen on the way over here, the concrete huge blocks that replace the old elegant suburbs.
Yeah, probably Bucharest was destroyed like more than 70% during the communist regime, and especially during Ceausescu's period. It was his idea of putting people into blocks. It was also a political decision in order to control them better. It was during the communist regime, the freedom of speech did not exist, so it was a kind of own universe in your small house or your large house, depending on each case, but people had their own universe over there, so it was possible to maintain a kind of a decent life when it comes especially to the necessity of speaking free and discussing about issues that were going on in the Romanian society. So he just got rid of these neighborhoods, and instead he placed huge blocks, concrete blocks, and he forced people to move over to these buildings.
Yeah, you actually saw Ceausescu.
Yes.
Tell us what he was like.
I saw him like 3 meters away. As pupils, we were supposed to meet him, especially when he was just visiting some parts of the country or different cultural or political or economical objectives within Bucharest or outside of Bucharest. So we were supposed to wear the official uniforms of the peoples belonging to the different communism structures within the school system, and to have flowers in our hands and to shout Ceausescu, Ceausescu. He was probably like 1.70 centimeters tall. He was not impressive at all as a person. Pupils were supposed to go next to him to hand him flowers, and he used to kiss the pupils. But then people say that he used to use a lot of special things in order to wash his face after all these meetings with people.
Was he with his wife? Because she was more hated than him, wasn't she?
Yes, she used to join him almost everywhere. She was together, she was next to him. But it's very difficult to assume that she was the one that manipulated Ceausescu, the one that actually is behind the disaster that Romania faced those days. It's obvious that she was evil. It's probably just the system in itself that was not capable of doing something good. They were just the representatives of an evil system. She was uneducated. She was not capable of speaking a correct Romanian language. It's very funny. The chemical formula of water is CO2. And she was supposed to be a famous chemist. And one of the jokes, it was that instead of saying CO2, she said in Romanian it would be CO2. She used to say CO2, which is the dogs, they have the... So, I don't know. Yeah, and so she was, but she was a very proud person, and she was influencing very much Ceausescu, especially in the late 80s.
Well, we're going to leave the cemetery now and leave them slumbering in supposedly their graves, which we found out now is maybe a mystery.
That was Anthea Page visiting the Genscher Civil Cemetery, and the intro music that we played at the beginning to get you in the mood was a track called Plunge Ma Mama Cudor, sung by Viorica Serbu from Romania. We'll be hearing more stories from Eastern Europe in the weeks to come.
Before the election, we heard protestations from now Lord Chancellor and Justice Secretary Ken Clark about social engineering, saying tax breaks for married couples were beyond the pale. But is the idea of social engineering really unknown to privileged movers and shakers like him? There is one institution based in London's Bloomsbury district that for over a century has been looking at aspects of society that could be designed to help the unfortunate, or, on the other hand, used to condition whole populations to accept otherwise unpalatable changes. Whether the Tavistock Institute actually do or not is hotly disputed, so Dialect's Tony Gosling tracked down psychology and sociology student Ian Cresswell, who has concluded they may be involved in psychological warfare, not just against a potential enemy, but against us.
My name's Ian Cresswell. I've been involved over the years in various research, especially in works of Carl Jung, Freud, and naturally I was read across the spectrum of thought. This is Tavistock Institute. There's a definition where Tavistock today is a clinic which is strictly for couple relationships, and it's a charity, where the Institute is still a serious research institution. In those days, prominent figures were people like John Bowlby, who was involved in child development, who did works on loss, separation, etc. Melanie Klein, also instrumental in child development. But there was many guest people, including Carl Jung, did speak there, and Freudians like Charles Rycroft, and the acclaimed maverick, D. Lane.
So what was the object of Tavistock?
It started about 1926 originally, and it was an interesting point. It was actually funded not by British money, but by the Rockefeller Foundation.
But what was its objective?
Research development, psychological, social development.
Now, you talked about separation. What was the point in looking into that, and what were they doing?
Originally, some of the early works that Tavistock did was based on trauma in the First World War, where many soldiers were shot just because they would not face battle. And they were treated as traitors, and there was no question they would have shot, but they were actually suffering from trauma. And it was only many years later that this was a speciality of Tavistock Clinic. And but and then it developed into like when children lose a parent or a sibling, the deep trauma is sustained often throughout their lives, and it, a lot of it was child oriented, and there was a lot of good work done by Tavistock. It was perhaps the greatest British institution on social psychology.
Do you think that it's possible that some of this knowledge that was gained was used for evil purposes rather than just to help people overcome the traumas we were talking about?
I've become aware recently of this being a very strong possibility. I found a very interesting thing on Wikipedia, but there's many other sources. This is just a quick, fast reference, perhaps not the best, but it's now basically involved in social research, I think more in conditioning people. But the important thing to remember is that the early works by people like Melanie Klein and John Bowlby became the template for social workers, teachers. In effect, it became the temple to worship. Older schools of analytic psychology, such as Carl Jung, which was more holistic and more spiritually based, tended to be ignored for more behaviourism.
What is behaviourism?
It's the void, it's emptiness, it's trying to reduce everything down to a minimum. It's almost making humans into animals.
How do you think that this might affect the thinking of social workers in the modern world then?
It may, in a way, alienate them from the actual person. They don't see a person as a person, they see a person almost as a part of a creed. An expectation of what to expect in each case rather than each person is different. I think it lacks warmth, myself, but I think what's worrying me now is that the Institute, its clients now, it does have private clients, but it also does work for the EU and also for government departments. But what is worrying is the fact that it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, which is Illuminati, and it is for social control. It is worrying, and it's not decrying. There's been many very good people who have studied there. The main people have probably done the work positively, but it's now it's been taken over and used for evil purposes, basically, to control people. It's a control tank.
How do you see modern psychiatry?
Lacking in depth and warmth.
Ian Cresswell there, speaking to Dialect's Tony Gosling about the Tavistock Institute, based in London's Bloomsbury District, not to be confused with the Tavistock Clinic.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, it's time to welcome once again the poet Tim Burrows. Hello.
Hi. Hi.
Oh, you came along last week and read some excellent poetry, and you've also got an event coming up soon at the Nova Scotia pub on Saturday the 31st of July, which involves a lot of poetry. Maybe we can chat about that in a second. But enthrall us with a poem.
This poem's called Lines of Fate and Lines of Age. It's about reading people's palms and that link to life, so... Life unfurls in the palms of hands, like curling valleys through mountains, worn out by the coursing rivers, like the wear caused by daily carriage, in lifting of personal baggage, or the softer caress of intimacy. Lines of fate, fingerprints of identity, lines of age, wisdom from maturity. A deep sea gorge with the side shift of tectonic plates, the lifeline portrays mortality. The love line sighs with fecundity, notches cut as the promise of births. Lines of fate, fingerprints of identity, lines of age, wisdom from maturity. In a child's hands, the lines are light, worn by soft exploration. In the adult, their courses are formed by the wear and tear of labour. Lines of fate, fingerprints of identity, lines of age, wisdom from maturity. The civil looks with psychic eye to the fate foretold with the stars in the sky as the map of the birth chart slowly unfolds. Lines of fate, fingerprints of identity, lines of age, wisdom from maturity. beauty products soften to slow the heavy tramp of age, but with the inevitability of history, time is carved into our face. Lines of fate, fingerprints of identity, lines of age, wisdom from maturity.
Thank you very much. I understand that palmistry runs in your family a little bit.
Yeah, so my gran and my great-gran used to read palms a bit, and my sister does charts a bit and things.
Okay.
There's a bit of that, yeah. So.
Well, if you liked that sort of style of poetry and want to hear a little bit more, tell me a little bit about your event that you've got going on, which involves the works of some local poets.
That's right. There's some local poets and local songwriters and two local film directors as well. One is Diana Taylor. The idea was that the Harbour Festival, I've noticed every year that the Harbour Festival happens, but there's not a lot of mention of Bristol's past links and the fact that all of this city's wealth and its history is linked to the sea and America and everything. And so the idea was it's kind of, there's some history in there, but it's kind of lighthearted, but it's to celebrate all the themes will be maritime. There's going to be a film about Cabot. There's going to be a film about Brunel, and a film by David Johnson on one of his poems. So it should be fun. And there's some new songwriters, Fabian Holland and Elliot Hall, writing new stuff for the event. So it should be fun.
Okay, yeah, and also I understand from this poster I'm looking at, there is a backdrop to be painted live by the Rolf Harris of Coombe Dingle, namely Chris Beckett. Good Lord. So that's upstairs at the Nova Scotia. Whereabouts is this, roughly?
It's in Hot Wells by the small bridge. You know, there's the big swing bridge, and then there's the small bridge, and it's just beside that. Very easy to find, and there's obviously going to be a lot of events around that weekend. So, but the tickets are limited because it's upstairs. So if you're interested, please turn up early or try and get a ticket from one of the performers.
Okay, and that's on Saturday the 31st of July, 8:30 in the evening. I understand you've got another poem as well. Is this one about Brunel, did you say?
Yes, this one's... film's being done on this as we speak, I think. It's about Brunel. There was some mummers did a play about Brunel recently in September, which I saw, which was great. But this is something I wrote about him, because obviously, again, the city's so linked to his, you know, the railway came through to Bristol and that brought a lot of prosperity. And then there's the suspension bridge and the Great Britain. So, you know, there's big things. But anyway, this is my... one on Brunel. It's called Cast Iron, Rivet, Girder and Stone. Framed by chains, shadowed by a tall hat, dwarfed by giant ships drawn along wide gauge rail track. Iron will, iron ways, cast iron industrial days. Persuasive adamantine, precocious, driven by stream, riveting his impact on the green undulating land, tunnels blown with dynamite, blood and sweat. Iron wills, iron ways, cast iron industrial days. Dreamer of engineered greatness that spanned a gorge, crossed the globe with speed to the antipodes. Living nearby, you never saw your gorge suspended. You had reached too far in all your designs. Your body was not made to last as long as cast iron, rivet, girder and stone.
Thank you, Tim Burrows, and hopefully more from you next week. And if you want to buy tickets for the events at the Nova Scotia pub, best place to get the tickets is the pub itself, down in Hotwells, and once again the event is on the 31st of July, 8:30 in the evening.
You can listen to BCFM live on the internet, www.bcfm.org.uk.
Conspiracy theories, love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In Secrets and Lies, he confirms the old saying, the truth really can be stranger than fiction when you take the time to dig out the hard facts behind the smokescreen of rumours and disinformation. David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to many riddles, modern and not so modern. This week, technology.
secrets and lies teased out by David Southwell. While today we enjoy greater access to information than ever before, we also have never lived in an age with greater secrecy. Despite a Freedom of Information Act, both in America and the United Kingdom, there has never been a time when more is classified, restricted, or deemed sensitive and therefore hidden from us. One of the biggest areas where governments keep the lid on what is going on is in their research and use of cutting-edge technology. When you research the area, it becomes clear that not only are enemy nations being misled about what is being developed, our elected officials often have no idea what the R&D budgets they vote for are spent on. Researched in secret laboratories, funded by government agencies that do not officially exist, and lied about when companies are asked what they are really making, this section will expose the frightening and bizarre side of new technologies being developed today across the world. It will also unravel the facts about those technologies that have been developed, used, and continue to be used that we still have not been told the full truth about. The research and development of new technologies has always had a clandestine element, especially in the cutthroat world of business, where there is a fear that rival companies could learn valuable commercial secrets. However, when technology is being developed for military and intelligence agency purposes, the secrecy and misinformation surrounding it reaches outstanding and even deadly levels of control over information. In 2007, the US military got its first chance to try out a weapon that can deliver a bout of intense, debilitating pain from a distance of more than 2 miles away. The ability to hurt and incapacitate the enemy from such a distance has been a long-cherished dream for many military strategists who believe that such a weapon could have a huge impact on tactics used in a war. However, the originally intended victims of the weapon are not enemy soldiers, but rioters, both foreign and domestic. The existence of the program to develop the new pain projection weapon was uncovered by the anti-weapons research organization, the Sunshine Project. They discovered that the University of Florida has been awarded a research contract to develop pulsed energy projectiles, PEPs, that according to a document they obtained would have the ability to induce pain suitable to disarm and deter individuals or to form barriers to the movement of large hostile groups. The weapon works by firing a laser pulse that generates a burst of expanding energy when it hits the target. According to the document, PEPs hitting a person would activate the skin receptor cells that transmit pain without the need for heat or chemicals. The project built on earlier work undertaken by the US Naval Studies Board that found that PEPs produced temporary paralysis in tests on animals. One of the aims of the work at the University of Florida is to be able to do this without creating any tissue damage. The US Army has other research programs not associated with the University of Florida that are looking into the possibility of developing the lethal applications of PEPs. When details of the project emerged, scientists working to control pain for medical reasons were outraged at their researchers being manipulated into a pain-generating weapon. Some, such as John Wood of University College London, were also worried that its ability to create excruciating pain meant that it would be used for torture. Such concerns are obviously not enough to stop the dreams of the military. On December 26, 2004, the world got an apocalyptic reminder of the devastating power of a tsunami when a massive undersea earthquake generated a destructive wave in the Indian Ocean. It killed at least 310,000 people across several countries, some as far as 5,000 miles away from the epicentre of the quake. The tsunami was one of the deadliest disasters in modern times, but it brought out some of the best characteristics of humanity as private citizens across the globe responded with amazing generosity. The tsunami also recalled some of the worst instincts of mankind for anyone who was aware of the secret history of research into tsunami bombs. Military interest in wave weapons started in 1915 when the explosion of a bomb-carrying ship resulted in a small tidal wave in the English Channel. Recalling the devastation that a tidal wave caused after Krakatoa erupted, the possibility of generating similar phenomena through the explosion of underwater devices began to be discussed. During the Second World War, a top-secret program called Project SEAL saw a series of experiments with tsunami bombs carried out off the coast of New Zealand. Under the direction of Auckland University Professor Thomas Leach, a series of underwater explosions in 1944 successfully triggered mini tidal waves. His work was considered so promising the US and UK governments believed Project SEAL could potentially be a devastating alternative to the atomic bombing of Japan. Leach's experiments, which involved laying a pattern of explosives underwater to create a tsunami, led to him being made a commander of the Order of the British Empire in 1947. Details of why the award was given were kept secret because development was still going on in the US. Papers relating to the wartime experiments have only recently been declassified, and details of research after 1946 are still secret. However, evidence emerged after the fall of the Soviet Union to show that the Russians had carried out research into using a tsunami bomb to devastate southern England and Holland without the radiation problems generated by a nuclear attack. Radio frequency identification, RFID, is a method of storing and retrieving data using devices called RFID tags. The tag can be the size of a grain of rice and can be attached or built into any item. The inbuilt transmitter allows it to broadcast data such as location information or specifics about the tagged product, such as price. The technology is being increasingly adopted in the retail sector, as it allows stores to track a product from the moment it leaves a depot all the way through to it going onto a shelf and eventually being bought by a customer. It allows for much tighter stock control and is an easy way of preventing theft from a shop, as the technology will trigger an alarm if someone tries to steal the item. Like the internet and the barcode before it, RFID is a spin-off from the needs of the Pentagon. The massive investment they have made in it, more than $100 million over the last few years, is driven by a logistical desire to track stores and equipment in fine detail. The Pentagon's role as the largest customer in the USA for many items has allowed them to demand that manufacturers use the technology and its own RFID standards, leading to its rapid take-up. Many civil liberties groups in the USA and elsewhere believe RFID will allow manufacturers and retailers to track their customers through what they buy. When the author was chief spin doctor for the organisation representing British retailers, the British Retail Consortium, major efforts were made to get him to publicly back RFID. He was even told by one of the PR companies representing an RFID manufacturer that there were no civil liberties concerns and that he should help persuade retailers to back the technology beyond the point of sale. When he pointed out this was a lie, the tack changed and generous sponsorship was mentioned. It was an offer declined, but it gives a good indication of how a lot of expert opinion you read and hear about is generated through a combination of lies and money.
Was our weekly extract from the People's Undercover Agent David Southwell's book Secrets and Lies, and that was read by Malcolm Grieve.
Well, the Avon Association of Drama's regular magazine has dropped on doormats around the region this week, and I'll be giving you contact details of how to be kept informed of the best in amateur drama around the region in a minute. But before that, our Tony Gosling, Dialect's very own, he's here to take us through the latest edition of Prompt Magazine. Hello.
Hi.
So, what is the Avon Association of Drama?
Well, it's been going for many years now. It started really as a sort of link-up between the Western Daily Press and the regional newspapers that were coming out of Bristol, and they publicised a lot of the amateur dramatic stuff that was going on in the region. And so that's why it's a kind of regional thing rather than just a Bristol thing or a Bath thing, and it goes right down into, you know, to Somerset and beyond and up into Gloucestershire. So it's an association of all the amateur dramatic groups in the region, and it goes right from just sort of small little parish halls to people like the Kelvin Players, who are semi-professional. So there's all sorts in there, really.
Cool. Well, what are the highlights coming up in the next few weeks?
Well, the summer is a bit of a slow season because obviously people are away on holiday, but yeah. We have Joseph Andrews from Henry Fielding's comic novel, an open air production in the Dairy Garden at Blaise Castle Estate. And that's going on from Tuesday the 20th to Saturday the 24th of July, starting at 7:45 in the evening. Tickets for adults are £8 and children £5. The box office for that is on 0117 904 2974. And they're asking also people to bring their own fold-up chair or rug. In each of the prompt magazines, we get a little diary of what's on in the next couple of months. And in July, there's not a lot else, but in September, there's more stuff which we can talk about maybe in a few weeks' time. But if you want something dramatic to do in August, the Drama Association of Wales is running two summer courses for amateur actors and directors at Aberystwyth University from the 15th to the 21st of August. Sex, Love and Clandestine Relationships in 20th Century Drama.
Oh, that's a bit racy.
It is. The tutor is Peter Waldridge, who was initially inspired by Pinter's play Betrayal, which charts his seven-year affair with Joan Bakewell. This course will explore scenes from a variety of plays, including Private Lives, Brief Encounter, The Blue Room, The Lovers and Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Acting the Bard is another course. The tutor is Richard Cheshire. Richard believes that learning should be fun, and this course is suitable and accessible for beginners as well as more experienced actors who want to refresh their skills and approaches to performing Shakespeare. These popular week-long all-inclusive residential courses give you the opportunity of working and playing hard for the price of a last-minute bargain holiday. Details are from Gary Thomas on 02920 452200. Or you can email gary@dramawales.org.uk.
Okay, so does it have like reviews of past performances and stuff like that?
It does. And the other thing that's going on at the moment is the Bristol Shakespeare Festival 2010.
Yeah.
Now, some of these have already gone, which is The Taming of the Shrew, Midsummer Night's Dream and Love's Labour's Lost. But we've still got Romeo and Juliet to come on the 29th of July, created by Illyria at Bristol Zoo Gardens. And coming up in August, we've got The Comedy of Errors. That's Shakespeare's Globe on tour at Ashton Court Gardens. And this is a non-for-profit organisation dedicated to bringing the freshest, most exciting Shakespeare productions to some of Bristol's most beautiful and unusual places each summer. The festival plays a host to a wide range of theatre companies from across the UK and each year transforms Bristol with an exciting programme of open-air and indoor performances. So that's just a taste of what's in this latest Prompt magazine.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Tony. If you're interested in getting Prompt, the subscription is £12 a year. The website is www.avondrama.org.uk. You can speak to the subscription secretary, Mark Graves, if you want to inquire or subscribe. He's on 01454 238 834.
You are listening on BCFM 93.2 FM. It is your voice and it is your choice.
Well, without any further ado, in his Sepultura t-shirt and a variety of entertaining rock badges, here's Jeff Sparks to tell us what's going on this week.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. This is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 22nd of July, and Wayne Hussey of the Mission fame and also Sisters of Mercy fame will be doing a solo acoustic set at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Friday, 23rd of July, and the Mekons will be performing with support from Gerard Starkey and also the Smokestack Shakers at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and recently Bristol Archive Records released an album titled The Bristol Punk Explosion 1977 to 1983, which features 20 tracks from the original Bristol punk scene. This is Social Security with a track from that album titled I Don't Want My Heart to Roll My Head.
I don't want my
That was Social Security with I Don't Want My Heart to Roll My Head from the album Bristol Punk Explosion, 1977 to 1983. Moving on to Saturday 24th of July and Purple Spiral Project. We'll be performing with support from Karma Diva and also Alien Stash Tin at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Also on 24th of July, the Eric Clapton tribute group Classic Clapton will be performing at the Tunnels near Templemead Station in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on 25th of July, William Control, also known as Will Francis of Aden, will be performing with support from Mavericks, Chaser Sunset and We Are Giants at the Barfly in Kingsway, Cardiff. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, that's all for this week. Dialect Radio is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM across Bristol at 12 noon every Sunday.
If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed, which will remind you every Friday when Dialect is online, or you can download our podcast from dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find a low bandwidth mono version of Dialect, if that's more suitable for you, at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning, or if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk.
The What's On Guide was by Jeff Sparks, and reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Studio production this week was by Johnny Royden and Lee Duffield. The producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute. So if you want to come along just to check us out, then please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find also on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Well, that was Dialect Radio. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
Wishing you a very good week. So from all the team in Queen Square Studio here, have a good week. Goodbye.